Good evening to our listening audience around the globe. Hey, this is The Buzz, Studio W, The Buzz, your global radio network. Hey, we circle the globe 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In our opinion, some of the finest broadcasting that you ever want to witness anywhere around the globe. Now, hey, welcome to the panel. I got my main man, Mad Mike. How are you, sir? Your mic is muted. Pardon the pun. Yeah, there you are.
Tell me that Mike was not on the mic.
Mike was not on the mic.
No. Yeah, sorry about that. I'm wonderful, Ray.
All right, Reverend Dimery, Dr. Dimery, how are you, sir?
Doing well. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. Hey, first of all, we want to say hello to Dr. Sims. She's not feeling well today. A little under the weather. So she says to you guys, she's going to miss you guys and miss this panel and miss this particular broadcast, which we'll talk about in a second. And also Ann has to tend to her mom today. Yeah. So Ann won't be here. So it's just us three that, the three musketeers. How about that? Okay.
We can do this.
Folks, this is, our panel already know what this is all about, but to you, our listener audience, this is one of, you know, I say this each and every week, one of our most important broadcasts of the year. Over the last, since we started the year, I think we started January the 8th back on the Boomerang Radio Show after a brief hiatus. And we were talking about, in December we were talking about Hollywood safety, how to be vigilant, refuse to be a victim. And those are excellent broadcasts. It's sad to say that we have to do these things today, but we must. Okay, the world is ever changing, and it seems like to me violence is on the rise. I don't know whether violence is really on the rise, or whether with the access to social media we'll get more information. I don't know which is factual and which isn't, but still.
It's hard to decipher because it depends on who's creating the statistics and who's marketing their own agenda. So it's really hard many times to get solid numbers that really mean something.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So either which way, folks, we must be vigilant and we must look out for ourselves and our families. And, you know, just it's okay to go out. You don't have to be paranoid everywhere you go, but pay attention to what you're doing. Tonight, we're going to talk about something that Dr. Dimery can attest to this, Mike. We have covered this program. Speaking of domestic violence, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We've covered this for several years, Mike, and we've also had more than one part. I think one time, Dr. Dimery, I believe we had at least three or four episodes of the same topic, I believe.
At least that many,
Mike. And so I'm glad to have you, because you investigated these, crimes, and let's call it for what it is, when you were, on the police force, on the sheriff's department, rather. You investigated these, and I'm sure you have some stories of your own that you can share with us. But before we do that, there is Mike sent me a video, and I watched this video yesterday. We're going to play the audio part of it. And this lady is a victim of domestic violence, you know. And so I think she's going to share a lot of light on not only what happened to her, but some things that you may have witnessed that you are involved with. You know someone that's involved with it. It could be a relative. It could be a close friend, a neighbor. It could be anyone. So we're going to start off with that. And then, Mike, we're going to break it down. And then you have a picture you want to show. And then we're going to break down, what this, young lady said. She said she was a victim. First time she was a victim, I believe she was 22 years old. Okay. So we'll get into this right after.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny. And he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair. And he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know, that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe, he bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the 3rd one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask. Because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser. Because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying. As if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence. Like me. Because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
All right, we're back. What a powerful, powerful, powerful statement there. This young lady is a survivor of domestic violence. Mike, there are some numbers that you have behind us. Would you share those with the audience for those who can't see the video?
Absolutely. So what's behind me on the screen, all of you that can see us, of course you can read for yourself, but this is the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And it is, and we'll repeat it throughout the show, and you can look it up on the internet if you need to. But it's 1-800-799-7233. And the last portion of that, the 7933, is SAFE. It's the word SAFE. And it's also, there's a TTY number up there, and also a way to discuss and have a chat if you need to. And we can go into those later if you want. But the big important number there is the 800-799-SAFE or 7233.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, there's, looking at, let me turn my camera on. Dr. Demery, I want you to chime in. Is Dr. Demery with us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. I want you to chime, in a little bit, because as a preacher, you also do quite a bit of counseling.
Yes, sir.
And, I don't know how often, you have to counsel, domestic violence victims, maybe the husband and wife together, or, can you share a little bit with us on that? Then we'll get into some statistics. We're going to break it down. And Mike being in law enforcement, both of you were in law enforcement. We're going to tackle some of these, do's and don'ts, some things to look out for, red flags. And, as the lady said, as this woman said, the most dangerous time for a victim is when she decides to leave. So, Dr. Demery, I want you to chime in before we get into some stats and also maybe perhaps some remedies.
Well, I think I've had several counseling sessions where this has occurred, and one of the first things I do, because that's getting out of my area of expertise, I refer them on to a therapist or counseling. And if, in some cases that I've had in the past, without revealing any names or anything, I've had the women have come to me, and the first thing I try to tell them to do is tell them the warning signs. And when they are present, I tell them, get out as fast as you can. Nothing that's in that house is more important in your life, because the stats, as you have seen, will show that it escalates. It does not de-escalate. Continues to get worse and worse and worse. And before you know it, the woman generally ends up dead or so badly beaten that she can't even get herself together. So depending on the circumstances, I will refer them to a therapist or tell them, don't go back home tonight. You go to a woman's shelter, because I have a list of women's shelters and places for women to go. And if there's kids involved, that complicates it, because they got to go back into the home to get the kids out and all that other kind of stuff. And a lot of times the women are still concerned about their possession and what that may have. I mean, rightly so, which I can understand. But nothing is more important in your life. And, you know, that's the thing that makes it very complicated. So, you know, the issue is what level are they at? And, you know, my wife is an expert in domestic violence. And so, you know, she has taught me some things about that. That, you know, there's really three different levels of domestic violence. There's mental, physical, and financial. And so you have to figure out, when you're in a counseling session, first of all, if you're in an area that's out of your expertise. And second of all, try to assess the safety level of the person. Because there are men who are victims of domestic violence as well. It's obviously rare, but there are men who have been victims of domestic violence, and they have to be in their end just as much danger as the women are. So I would say, along with what Mike and you have compiled, William, is to determine the assess the level of threat and to see where they're at in it, because it can be very serious, and a lot of people have lost their lives over,
Absolutely, absolutely. And Mike, you know, I tell you, we talked about this earlier, and we're going to talk about the forms of violence, the main types of, main types of domestic violence. What are the phases of domestic violence, the cycle of domestic violence? But I want to start here, because I want to tell what is domestic-based violence? Well, you know, that is violence committed by someone in the victim's domestic circle. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be a partner, but it includes partners and ex-partners, immediate family members, other relatives, and family and friends. The term domestic violence is used when there is a close relationship between the offender and the victim. One thing this young lady was speaking of, how do they get into your psyche? How do they get to be friends? How do they get to be your lovers? How do they get to be your husbands? Well, a couple of things. They are, in the very beginning, Mike, I'm sure you can attest to this, they are extremely charming.
Charming. Charming.
Oh, they will gain your confidence. And she mentioned something else. And they will put their future victim on a pedestal. All right. And they're extremely charming, and then they will isolate you. But I'm going to stop right there, Mike, because I want you to jump in, and talk about that a little bit.
Gosh, there's so much to cover here. And I know we only have the 2 hours. I'm missing the ladies here. I wish they were both here. I hope they're okay. I would add one more form to what Dr. Demery brought up. He brought up the physical abuse, the psychological abuse, the economic abuse. But there's also a sexual abuse
Absolutely.
Side to this that maybe the other two don't manifest themselves. But it's, so there's, I think there's really four forms to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talk today and I throw out numbers and statistics and such, be aware that these statistics, it depends where they come from, who made them. There are a lot of them are skewed because of underreporting on the parts of the ladies, certainly, and as men as well. The men are macho, and they don't want to admit that they've been beaten up. And I talked with William yesterday. I worked certain cities here that were underprivileged cities. They were economically challenged. And so there was a lot of domestic violence and domestic abuse in those cities because of frustration, because of lack of income, because of drug and alcohol abuse. There may be factors that were apart from the family where they were beaten or abused when they were young. Mental stress problems, employment, poverty, education, being a young parent. Sometimes you end up in a self-defense position in domestic violence where you're defending yourself from getting beaten. Certainly, I'm going to repeat it again, the drug and alcohol is a huge contributing factor. Suspicion of infidelity. You become so paranoid that your loved one is cheating on you. So that's another way they can start these arguments. And I'll add one more, because William used to live out here in the Inland Empire with me. And during the summertime, things could easily get into the triple digits where you've got 105, 107, 110, 112 degree heat. And when you're in an economically challenged area, a lot of these places, especially years ago when I started in law enforcement, there was no such thing as an air conditioner. If you were lucky, if you had a swamp cooler, which didn't always work very well. So as heat would go up and there was no air conditioning, I also noted that domestic violence and violence in general would increase because people, they're uncomfortable and they lash out. Also, one of the contributing factors is you look at our media every day, they're talking about all the negative things that go on. Media starts out with negative and they continue running all the negative press they possibly can. So media, television is a contributing factor. Movies, the violence in our movies, the games that our children play. So all of these things are very common in causes, and I would list at the top, and I Dr. Demery, I'd like your opinion, but I would probably list, I'm going to give you the top two, drugs and alcohol abuse, and probably economic issues, where there's not enough money to raise a family or to survive very well. So those are my top two. Dr. Demery, what do you think?
Well, I would also include the fact that, and William, you can comment after I make this statement, is there's also what they call the cycle of abuse, because a large percentage of abusers have been raised in a home where there was abuse. For example, you know, a young man watches his mom be beaten or abused by the father or the grandfather or the great-grandfather. And so there's what's called a cycle of abuse that occurs, that it goes, you know, that term that's used in the Bible, which I don't necessarily agree with, but it has some merit, generational curses. And so there's that factor as well, that when there has been a history of the abuse in one's life, there is a strong, you know, tendency. Like, for example, someone who has been molested by someone or a family member become abusers themselves. And so that's the cycle of abuse that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, wouldn't you think that it'd be the exact opposite if they grew up with those kind of historical backgrounds and such, and they watched these bad things happen, and they were part of the bad things happen? You would think the opposite would happen, and they grow up and say, "That's, I would never be like that. I will never let that happen to me. I will never let that happen to my loved one. When I grow up, I'm going to marry and care for my loved ones." You'd almost think it'd be the opposite, but because of these historical factors, it's not.
You're right. You're 1,000% correct. And you know, Mike, that's an excellent point, Dr. Demery. Go on.
Economic status either, because there are people that are very rich that are abusers. There are people that are poor that are abusers. So the socioeconomic strata has nothing to do with it.
Okay. Well, you know, my thing is, I think this is what I think about that as far as the economics. I think that the people who do the less reporting are the wealthier ones. I was telling Mike this yesterday because we talked about this as well. Sometimes, and I'm going to tell you, this is really fascinating. I'm not a psychologist or anything like that. I believe that economics can play a role in that, because, and I'm going to tell you why, because a lot of men who cannot support, their families and things like that, they feel inadequate, which might just piss them off, and they have, it's a trigger point for them. I think it can be, a factor. I don't believe that it happens. I don't know what the stats are, but I believe it happens just as much in your, well-to-do households as it does, in your poor households. I'm going to say, because a lot of guys, who are wealthy, and this happens across the board, so I don't think that we can, just pinpoint this, one way or the other. I believe that you have narcissists on both sides, but I think that you have a lot of greedy, wealthy men that hold the economic portion over these women's heads. As a matter of fact, the article that I'm reading right now does say that economics does play a role in it. You know, it says that it does. Like it says, let's see, there were four types of abuse. What we're looking at. I'm looking at it. I had it right here. Physical violence, sexual violence, psychological violence, and economic violence. So I think that it does, but I don't think that we can say the poor abuse their spouses more than the rich, or the rich more than the poor. I don't know, but I do know that it happens in the poor families. I'm going to tell you. Also, Dr. Demery, you can attest to this. Some preachers abuse their wives. They abuse their wives and also their kids. There are stories about preachers molesting their own kids. So it happens across the spectrum. I don't think that we can blame one thing, or one thing could be, it could be many factors that could lead to this violence. Either which way is horrible. And what Morgan was saying, I believe her name was Morgan, she was saying that this cat, talk about, yeah, he was well educated, apparently well educated, but yeah. What a weak man, though. He was well, and who knows how? Oh, he did mention about how his stepfather how he was violently abused as a child. That can play a factor in it. I don't believe in generational curses. That's not, I don't believe that. I do believe in generational indoctrination. Okay. I do believe that. I've watched programs where, these were, young men and they were on TV and they abused their wives. And matter of fact, the wife couldn't, he dictated what she ate. Okay. When she went to bed, when she got up, where she went, what she wore. And she couldn't dare look, up. She had to walk with her head down. I mean, like she was some sort of animal or some type of slave. Mike, your take.
On which part?
I mean, pick any part you want. But what I'm saying, I don't think we can pinpoint one particular thing or one particular group of people and universally says, because they're poor, this happens, or because they're rich, this happens. I think it happens across the spectrum, and I think it has to do with the individual themselves. I think
it does. It does. Well, and I agree with both of you that it does occur across the spectrum. The very rich and the very poor and everyone in between, it can happen to all of them. I just, in my personal experience in law enforcement, I have seen, now maybe it's again, it's a factor of underreporting, but when I would work in a socioeconomic area or city where, education was low, marriage rate was young, or marriage didn't happen at all, and kids were born early or to very young parents, problems with unemployment, problems with finances. And when you add all, it's kind of piggybacking, and when you have all those factors start to piggyback and stack up, the odds are against you. So you can be very rich and an abuser, I completely agree, but I saw more occur in cities that were economically challenged, educationally challenged, than I saw in cities where people had good jobs, they lived fairly good lives, they had decent education. So, and we had less drug use in areas where people were affluent versus cities that were very poor. You saw a very high increase in drug and alcohol abuse. So, again, it's you start to stack all these common causes, and you get enough darts thrown on your dartboard, and it can happen to you more so than other areas.
You know, I tell you, Dr. Demery, and please address this as you, if you will. I know that men who abuse their wives, and which is horrible, and what's even worse, if they do this in front of their children, what kind of scars are they putting on their children? Now, that child could turn out one of a few ways, right? That child could mimic the father, or a child could go the opposite way, which we hope that they would. But what scars are they putting on them? I think that our childhood, I know that our childhood memories are precious. And if our only impression of our parent is that, he was a bastard. He was, just a horrible, horrible individual. Those are
monster.
A monster. That is crazy. And not only that, you're instilling, in many cases, fear in that child, which can affect them other ways in life. It could make them afraid to, say, get a job, or afraid to date someone, or there's a fear. Dr. Demery, please jump in here, because, the Bible talks a lot about fear. And when, like Mike just mentioned just now, and he used the word monster, I have to agree. And if the father is violent, that can instill fear in that child, which can manifest itself in other ways. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, I would say it would definitely cause emotional, psychological scars, you know, that could be irreversible, and it would need to go into some type of therapy. And many kids have shot and killed their fathers, or who the perpetrator was, because they saw the abuse occurring. And many women have killed their husbands because of abuse.
Yeah.
So I think it can each individual case has to be assessed on its own merit, and I think you can't draw, you know, a standardized case across the board, because I think their statistics will show there are certain tendencies and there are certain traits that occur, you know, when cases happen. But like, for example, you have to be, you know, very careful, because you have people that bully, you know, the family. When the husband comes home, you know, everything has to be the way he says, and this has to be done, and all the chores have to be done. If not, you get bullied. And the bullying generally will lead towards some level of violence. And the people that I've counseled over the years where that has happened, I have been very careful at handling the situation, because I don't want them to get into any more trouble. Here's one quick example. When I was on active duty, I think I told this story before, William. I'll be brief, but I told this story before when I was aboard. I was at a Desron, and a Desron is a destroyer squadron. And there was, we had about 10 or 12 ships in this destroyer squadron. And this one ship that I went to, the senior officer on board was a master chief. And he said, "Chap, I want you to talk to this one individual, because there's something that's not right in his life." And to make a long story short, what happened was his wife had come up to the ship one day to visit, and she was built like a linebacker. I mean, this woman weighed about 400 pounds, and when she walked, it was like, bam, 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 bam.
Oh, Lord.
And he was a tiny, frail guy. She was beating holy hell out of him. She had a rolling pin, and she was beating the hell out of this guy. You know, she was taking his money. He had no money to eat. His clothes were always, you know, in a disarray and whatnot. And so we had to get him out of that situation. And she came up there to the ship one day to find out why her money wasn't coming in, because we had shut her money off. And I was afraid of her. You know, and I was and I'm saying, this is the business, man. You better have some partners with you, man. And I'm kidding you. I kid you not. But, you know, all joking aside, the thing is, I think each situation has to be assessed individually. And you have to really look at the cycle of violence, because it generally begins somewhere. And come to find out, when I actually sat down and talked to her, she was abused by her dad. So she became an abuser herself. And that's the cycle of violence that you have to break. Now, right. You know, when it gets to the point where, for example, individuals like Mike have to get involved and law enforcement has to get involved, it's gotten pretty serious at that point. And it's at the point where there's legal precedent involved. I mean, you would hope you could stop it before it gets to that point to where it becomes a long-term thing, because that's where the real damage occurs, when it you know, occurs over a long period of time and there is irreversible damage that takes place. So I think, you know, each case has to be dealt with on an individual level. But like you said, William, there are statistics and there are cases, like Mike was saying, where there are certain factors that presuppose one to being more
vulnerable
to certain levels of violence. And obviously alcoholism and drug abuse, history of domestic violence, all those issues have a factor. But one thing we do know, that one thing that leads to domestic violence is if the person had been raised in a home or had been in an abused situation themselves. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much static across the board.
Right. And you know something else, and speaking of sexual violence, a lot of times, and the guilty person will strike out against the innocent one. And what I mean by that, let's say the husband, Mike, you might even know something about this. Let's say this guy has been cheating on his wife, and she caught him. And there was a situation even with, there was a story about Herschel Walker. His girlfriend or his wife or one of his women caught him with another one. and he got up in this other one's, I mean, the one's face that caught him, you know, and threatened to beat her up. You see?
He blamed her.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. He's projecting onto her, his own ill will, and blaming her because he did it. I mean, so, I mean, the thinking behind the abusers, they are, absolutely illogical a lot of times. And like you said, then a lot of times they will, assume that the spouse is cheating. Perhaps they are. And they assume that his spouse is doing the same thing. And so they're going to accuse them, of violence. I mean, accuse them of cheating on them when they are the guilty ones in the first place. So Mike, what are your information on that or, your experience with those types of cases?
Well, so it's manipulation is what it comes down to, is displacement of blame. If you're going to point the finger at me, I'm going to turn it right back around and point it at you, because this wouldn't have happened unless you, if you would have been a better wife, if you would have been a better lover, a better spouse, if you would have, if the house was cleaner or my clothes were in better order, or they're manipulators, they're master manipulators, and they will come up with everything from the kitchen sink to throw at you to make it your fault, because it's never their fault.
No.
Couldn't. And I have a theory about what Dr. Demery's talking about what they called, historical factors, which is growing up in an abusive home. And my theory is this, and I've taken a fair amount of psychology and I think it bears out, but as children grow up, we've talked about this many times about being sponges. So they're just sponges that are dry, that are ready to absorb whatever moisture is around them. And unfortunately, they can absorb toxic moisture. And I believe that when they're exposed to this type of violence in the home, they absorb all of that, certainly. And the reason why it hangs in or hangs on throughout their life is because they don't know there's a better way or a difference.
Mm.
Because they've been exposed to one way of being raised in a family, and they think that that's the norm, and it's not. But they don't know that. So they go, well, I got to come home and beat the wife, right? And it's not always the wife, but primarily it's the women are taking the hit on most of this. We can get into the statistics later. But certainly the women are more vulnerable than the men. But that's what happens. They go up and go, oh, I just... That's what I gotta do, right? Mm-hmm. Gotta come home and yell at her, scream at her, and tell her how horrible she is, and break down her self-esteem.
Right.
So you know, so I can manipulate her more.
You know, I just thought about something too, Mike. Say children who show early extreme of violence themselves, maybe to their little or younger brother, or maybe to, an animal, the family dog or the family cat, and I'm wondering if there's a correlation there, or if there's something, if there's a connection there, between what they're doing to their younger sibling and or their animals, in relationship to how the dad is treating the mom or the mom's treating the dad in a violent way. Does that make any sense at all?
I categorize that more as a red flag, and I'd separate it a little bit, and let me explain why. If you have three kids in the family, they're all being raised in that same environment, in that same sphere of what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And only one of them abuses the animal, and only one of them beats up their brothers and sister, and only one of them acts out in school. I tend to look at that more like that child has a mental health issue. When the other two children or the other three children or five children don't express any of those negative attributes. So I think that's more of a mental health issue with the one, rather than the many, I'm not sure. Dr. Demery?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, they could have a problem with being bipolar. They could have a chemical imbalance.
Chemical imbalance, yeah, right.
When things occur, you see those type of behaviors expressed. Now, that's out of my wheelhouse. That's more in the area of where Dr. Sims and, others are. But there's exceptions to the rule, because there you can have a child that is raised in a really good home, both parents are educated and whatnot, and this child just acts insanely. And many of the times
when those kids are evaluated, they have a chemical imbalance, they're bipolar, they have, you know, certain psychological issues that cause them to be that way. And then when they get on their medication, they're okay. Because we know there's a lot of those kids and parents as well, when they get off of their medication, they recidivate and go back to that original behavior that caused the red flags in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that we really have to consider, you know, as well, and that's why law enforcement has to be so careful, because I remember it's been a long time, Mike, since I was a cop, much longer than, you know, from when you were a cop, and things have changed. But, I mean, we would always send a minimum of two police officers to a domestic violence call or potential domestic violence call, because the woman will see the husband being handcuffed and hauled off, and then she'll jump on you because she sees her breadwinner going out the door.
I love him!
Right, right. She sees that one who's provides for the family going out the door, going to jail, and if she doesn't take his defense, when he does get out, unfortunately, if there's not a restraining order of him, he'll come and either kill her or severely beat her again. So there's a lot of those issues that are involved in this that are, you know, very complicated. That's why I think you have to look at each individual case on an individual basis, because you get those that will become codependent. You know, like you said, Mike, that, you know, I love you. I want you to be, you know, here always, no matter what. And codependency is very dangerous. You know, because you can defend, like, for example, in alcoholism, you know, codependence will defend the alcoholic no matter what, you know, and it's a really dangerous situation. And when I see it, you know, my first reaction is to try to protect the individual, and the perpetrator is the one who has to be dealt with. And I always tell women, don't go back to the home if you can help it. You know, if the kids involved, that just complicates the situation. But if the woman has been beaten before, I tell her, if you go back, you're just going to get beaten again, and maybe you're going to end up, I'm going to end up doing a funeral rather than, you know, trying to get you a place to stay for the night.
Absolutely. You know, go on.
I've had husbands come up to my church before and try to, you know, assault me. Where is she at? What did you do? What did you tell her? Where'd you send her? And I tell him, look at here, brother. You better get it together or I'm about ready to open up 300 pounds of whoop ass. Stuff together. You know, I mean, I've had to do that. When I was a Navy chaplain, I had this one, guy, and he wasn't even an officer. He tried to come up and assault me. And then I stood up in my desk and he realized, well, I'm biting off a little bit more than I can chew. So, you know, not because I was an officer and he was enlisted, but, you know, it was a size factor. So I said, I'll take these bars off my collar and we'll go outside and handle this. So, you know, you have to be, I think, very prudent in how you involve yourself, because there's legal matters that can be, you know, involved as well. You have to be careful not to get yourself involved, because they will come after you. You know,
or make it worse. Yeah, you don't want to say things or do things to make it worse either.
Oh, absolutely. I've heard about situations where someone tried to rescue a battered woman, and she ended up turning on the person that tried to help. I don't know how that works, but again, there's a fear factor there as well. There's a story going back a few years when I was in California, Southern California, where both of you gentlemen are now. And Mike, I'm sure you've heard about it, Dr. Demery. I don't know whether you've heard about it or not, but perhaps you did. There was something going on in the high schools there in California. And I don't know whether there were several schools involved or whether this was a phenomenon that went around. Well, you know how things tend, in those circles, things travel. The young people in one part of the city or state or whatever it is know what the elders are doing. They get information out quickly. But anyway, there were young girls that were being abused by their boyfriends, so to speak. And it was this crazy thing, a syndrome or whatever it was, that they felt that if the boyfriend abused them, That means that he cared about them. Mike, you
he must love me. Yeah.
Yeah, that was going on in California. And it was just, I mean, I saw stories about it. It absolutely blew my mind. And I'm saying, wait a minute, hold it. Domestic violence is bad enough. But this is starting at a much earlier age than I would have anticipated. And the mentality there is it was okay. As a matter of fact, it was almost like they wanted that to happen because they wanted to feel love. The psychology behind it, Mike, what would you attribute that to?
Negative attention is still attention.
Mm.
And if you can get negative attention, it sort of fills a hole in your soul a little bit as well. And let me throw out a little bit of statistics here that I tend to believe. Let's say this. Let's start with this. 90 to 95% of domestic violence is perpetrated by males, by men.
Right.
So 90 to 95%. I don't think that's a big shocker to anybody.
No, not at all.
The out of the supposed 10 million people a year that are victims of some type of domestic violence that we've already talked about, 1 in 4 women, this will occur with 1 in 4 women, and the age group for those women, we're talking about age here, so I want to get into this. The age group is between 18 and 34 is where they're most vulnerable age-wise.
Mm.
And 1 in 7 men. And the interesting thing about the age is the younger the male, the more likely that he will be the person committing the violence.
Okay.
So young males are the ones committing the violence, and young females 18 to 34 are the ones that are the victim.